it's my new obsession. Yeah, pink, it's not even a question. Pink on the lips of your lover. Cause pink is the love you discover.
Welcome to the Marilyn York Show. Warning, this program is not for the faint of heart. Listen at your own peril. If you have questions about marriage, relationships, or divorce, call 823-1920. And now, here's your host, Marilyn York.
Good morning. You guys are on the Marilyn York Show. This is Marilyn York, and I have a guest in the studio, Jason Natora, or Natwara, however he likes to say his name. Jason, tell us how you like to say your name.
It's Natwara.
Okay, there you go. And I said it two different ways. So now we have a third option. Jason is a local marriage and family therapist who is also a master addiction counselor. And today we are talking about addiction, drug and alcohol addiction, because it's such a prevalent thing in Nevada as well as other places. But here in particular, we were recently voted the second drunkest city in Men's Health magazine. So that's good for business, Jason. There you go.
Yeah, there's plenty of business in Washoe County for sure.
Unfortunately, and in the legal world, I will say that many of my colleagues could use your services. I am allergic to alcohol and therefore am not addicted to that. But we're not going to talk about my shopping today, Jason, okay? We're okay. Not here for me. For those of you listening that like to call in and ask Jason questions, our call-in number, as always, is 823-1920. So feel free to call in and ask him questions, or you can always join the Facebook fan page if you aren't already a fan. And now you don't have to commit. It's perfect. You can just say you like me instead of you're my, quote, fan. And then you can get on there and post questions during any of the shows or any other time, and I will read them on air if you don't want to call in. So, Jason, let's start with how you establish whether or not you have an addiction to, let's say, alcohol or drugs. And I may focus more on alcohol today because I think it's kind of the sleeper addiction that people don't really recognize and don't take care of as much due to the fact that it's legal. And I feel like there's a tolerance for women more than men. They like women drunk, especially good-looking ones. They get laid more, I think. I don't know. But let's talk about both at the moment. If someone thinks they have a spouse or a loved one that's addicted, or somebody thinks they may personally be addicted, what would you suggest would be the first step to figuring out whether this is a bigger problem?
Well, probably the best thing to do is to have a professional evaluation. However, to answer your question about how does somebody decide if they have an addiction problem or not, a lot of times for me is their behavior creating more problems in their life for them? And a lot of times, if you want to label them an alcoholic or an addict, they might have ego defense mechanisms that they don't see that they have a problem. So they're rationalizing or justifying their use. And so a lot of times when they come in for the evaluation, they're minimizing their use or they're not really telling the whole truth. And so then the evaluation might not be as effective.
Well, obviously, at some point in the drinking through the night game, one should lose, conceptually, how many drinks they've had. Like, how do they really count? If you get really hammered, obviously you can't count very well, and nor would you. So I do suspect that when they're self-reporting, they probably don't always even know the answer.
Right. That's true, too. And they don't know what a standard drink may be. I mean, 4 ounces of hard liquor would be the same as 12 ounces of beer. And so a lot of people have a hard time calculating the number of standard drinks they're using in an hour. And alcohol is an interesting drug because to a certain extent, it's a stimulant and you have fun, but a lot of people drink past that point, way past that point, and then they just take this downward turn in their behavior and everything else, and that's when it leads to the far end of continuum. When they start to see blackouts, that's a clear sign that there's a problem that they need to start to deal with.
Do people have blackouts when they first begin the drinking, or no, is that something that develops after a period of time?
Right. If you talk about somebody who really has a problem with alcohol, they talk about it as a progressive disease. So over time, it gets worse and worse. And so the blackouts don't come on early. It's further on in their addiction that it starts to happen. And for me, that's an indicator, especially with alcohol, that we really need to look at that and get this person to look at their behavior, because they might be denying that it's a problem at all.
Has anyone ever blacked out due to shopping? I just want to know what I should be looking for. Okay, so we have the blackout syndrome. What about loss of memory without the blackout? I know there's people that are like, I didn't even know what I did last night, but they were coherent because I watched them be semi-conscious.
Exactly, right. Well, and that can explain a blackout, because a lot of times during the blackout, they are behaving what appears to be normally, only a little inebriated.
A little bit sillier.
Right, but they don't remember any of it. But other times people may be used that as an excuse for their bad behavior.
Sleeping
or
with
use
ugly
alcohol.
People.
Exactly. Use Definitely. Alcohol as an excuse to go ahead and do the thing that they wouldn't do if they weren't intoxicated.
Don't people always say that you won't do anything out of your character when you're drunk? And having never been drunk, help me out here, Jason, that supposedly it'll lessen your, you know, inhibitions so that you may be more likely to do something, but it would be in your nature anyway. Like, you're not going to kill someone when you're drunk if you're not that type of person, but you might take your shirt off at a bar. I don't know.
I kind of disagree with what you're saying. I mean, okay. I don't like it when people use alcohol as an excuse.
Yeah.
Is that what you're kind of saying?
Well, no, I think people say that no matter how drunk you are, you're never going to do anything outside your, you know,
regular. Oh, no, I disagree with that also, especially as it progresses on to further stages in a problem. People generally start to go against what I call their core values. And
that's
so a lot of times
question,
the alcohol becomes more important than their wife or significant other or children. And so that's where it gets very – that's why I added marriage and family therapy into my addictions practice, because I see it as a systems problem. And if somebody has this alcohol or drug problem, they might not recognize it, but it's affecting everybody around them.
Well, and there's always the he's a bad drunk, a mean drunk, you know, those kind of men or women that are violent when they drink but are not otherwise violent at all.
Exactly.
I mean,
right.
I do know of those people. I've seen a few in my time. Or the people that are jerks when they're sober and only nice when they're drunk.
Right.
That's the sad exception.
Well,
we don't want them to get sober, Jason.
Well, and that's another family systems issue. A lot of times in families that there is a payoff for the person to continue to be drunk. The rest of the family likes it when they're passed out, or you know what I mean? And so when they start to get sober.
That's a bad thing. They like it when they're passed
right,
out.
Right, yeah. And so what it reminds me of is I used to do anger management groups as well as a lot of addiction counselings in the local agency. And this one guy, a light bulb went off in his head during this anger management group. He said, I don't have an anger management problem. I have an alcohol problem.
Yeah.
And so it's exactly what you said. And in the big book or in AA, they talk about this Jekyll and Hyde phenomenon.
Yeah.
I think for sure that's what happens is when alcohol gets into their brain, I think something clicks where they just start to go against their values. The people have a real addiction or dependence problem. They go against their values and towards the alcohol. And that's very hard for people who've never had the problem to understand.
Yeah, I don't understand.
Right, because it's like, why do they keep hurting themselves and other people?
Well, it doesn't taste good to me either. I'm like, what is the temptation exactly? And you get that really nice beer gut. Like,
yeah.
Let's talk about that. Yeah, I don't understand it. I don't understand the addiction period, like the propensity to do something against your will, particularly when it's bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
I just cannot get my head around it.
Yes, so. And that's a big thing that I see a lot over the years, and I teach at UNR, and I have about 100 students in class, and it really breaks down about 50-50. I mean, half of the people are on the moral model, which are like, I don't understand, why don't they just quit? And then the other people are on the disease concept model, where they're saying this is a disease, it's a medical problem, it's more than people can handle without additional help and support.
Well, I agree with that, but I also think it's a personality thing to some extent, because there's people that can't quit, you know, picking their fingers or eating donuts too. Mm-hmm. And there's no physical disease, although donuts do spike some certain goodness in my brain. I've had a few. So, but you know what I mean? I do think there's a personality component. I would suspect you would maybe agree that there are people that you have helped through addiction that kick it much better than others.
Absolutely. And then, so then that would go back a little bit towards the disease concept idea, because my experience has been the people who have a family history,
I was going to say the hereditary,
of having alcohol and drug problems usually have a harder time giving up alcohol and drugs than the people who don't. And so for me, I've had that come up so much that I do believe there is a genetic component to it. And so that's why I like to look at the family history, because if I see, they say, oh yeah, mom and dad on both sides, and then grandma and grandpa on both sides,
sure,
and it's just prevalent throughout their family, I'm honest with them and say, you're going to have a harder time quitting than maybe some of your friends.
Isn't that the old nature versus nurture question too, though? Because obviously it's socially not only acceptable, but perhaps preferred within the familial line. You know, all the family reunions have a lot of Budweiser or,
right,
you know,
okay,
whereas you go to my family events and there's not one drop of alcohol. You'd have to like drink rubbing alcohol at my parents' house to get it.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's just, you know, I wonder how much of it is social, because.
Well, that's a great question, because for me, we'll get a little personal. I'll talk about my family. I had an alcohol and drug problem, and I quit a little over 8 years ago. But number one, I had the genetics. Both my mom and my dad and grandparents on both sides had problems, especially on my dad's side. And then so I had my first beer when I was probably 13 or 12.
Yeah.
And that was from my uncle. And then so every family occasion, we were all just drunks. And then so every anniversary or wedding, it's just a huge occasion. And then so the last time I was drunk, I was thinking about this the other day, was my cousin's wedding. I grew up partying with him.
Well,
and doing drugs.
And if you're the one guy not drinking at those events, it pisses them off. It, you know, brings to attention the fact that other people are doing something that may be negative too.
Right.
So.
Well, in my own family, when I quit drinking, it made everybody around me uncomfortable and still.
That's, yeah, I would think so. Mm-hmm. When we get back from the break, we're going to hear a word from our sponsors. We're going to talk about the formal evaluation process a little more and what those evaluations entail and how you can hopefully not beat them if you're on my side of the case and want them to come out accurately. We'll be right back.
Everything seems to go wrong when I stop drinking. Everything seemed to go my way last night. Everything seems so wrong to me this morning. I know things will be brighter later tonight.
You're back on the Marilyn York Show, and welcome back. Thanks for hanging in with us. We have Jason Natwara on, and we are talking about addiction, alcohol, drugs, you know, Marilyn shopping. And if you would like to call in, please do 823-1920 and ask your questions. We are about to get into the formal alcohol and drug evaluation process, which is one that I am familiar with due to my line of work in the divorce world, but I'd like others, listeners, to be familiar with it as well. But before we get into that and change subjects, let's take our caller who's been holding patiently. Devin, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Hi, Devin. What's your question?
Well, I was wondering, what could I do if my wife is lying to the court about having an alcoholism problem? I know you guys were just talking about that, alcoholism and families, and her family has a history of alcoholism, and she's not telling the court that.
Do you have children involved in this?
Yeah, one.
Okay. And are you guys currently separated?
Yes.
So you know she's got a drinking problem. Mm-hmm. Have you advised the court about the things that you know, specifically like how much you think she's drinking and whether she's driving and that's...
Yeah, I told my attorney, but you know, she's lying about her family having alcoholism problems, and I know that they do.
Well, the family's not as important to the court in the sense of unless they have direct, you know, contact or supervision of your child. But as far as she's concerned, I like to tell my clients to gather as much evidence as they can. If you're not residing in the same home, dig through the trash can. I mean, honestly, they throw the alcohol bottles away.
Really?
And they lie about how much they drink, and I go photograph, you know, go dig through her trash. There's nothing illegal about it, particularly because you guys are still married, but pull all of her things out of the trash can and photograph them over maybe a week or two. And then I would do a request for a formal drug and alcohol evaluation. But before you do that, you want to line up some evidence because we're about to get into the formal evaluation process and how reliant it is on accurate self-reporting. So in order to counteract her propensity for downplaying her problem, the more evidence you have and the more you can be involved in that process, I think it'll be better. And if you stay tuned, Jason will explain what that process is and how you can try and help the accurate findings in the process. So sit tight.
That's great.
And hopefully you'll learn a few things. And I would, you know, make sure your attorney's doing the right thing with the information.
I will. Thanks.
Thanks for calling in, Devin. So, Jason, that's a perfect segue for us into the process. So what is the evaluation? What does it entail?
Well, first of all, what I was thinking of to answer Devin's question is it comes up quite a bit that is a problem, that the evaluator can only count on the self-reporting of the client that comes in. And so in legal cases, oftentimes – they minimize quite a bit. And there are some instruments like the SASE. It's a substance abuse subtle inventory scale that they is supposed to tell if they're manipulating it.
Because so it asks the same question 9 different ways, basically.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right.
It's in like 100 questions,
right.
Multiple choice. I've taken it.
And most of the courts like to see all of substance use evaluations have that done. However, what I recommend clients is if the evaluator has access to all records, and legal records, medical records, other records, otherwise they could include that. The problem is the client pretty much has to consent for that.
Well, the court can order it, and if you have two attorneys on each, you know, one on each side, since Jason and I had this conversation a while back, I've been trying to include in the court order that the evaluator must receive all pleadings filed with the court, because before you get an evaluation, you have to make allegations to substantiate that there's probably a problem. And those allegations would be something that Jason would love to read.
Exactly.
You know, from the husband's perspective in Devin's case, what does he believe indicates that she has a drinking problem? How much alcohol is she consuming? How often? What is her behavior? Is she still metabolizing it? Is she blacking out? Is she driving drunk? You know, is she home in the day? What time is she drinking?
Right.
How many? What are the consequences of her drinking? You know, financial, relationship, otherwise. So those are the things that Jason's absolutely right. They always downplay because they're, you know, on the verge of losing custody of their children when it comes in front of our courts. They have every reason to downplay it.
Well, and I think if the problem is severe enough, they have every reason to be concerned that the system might step in and make sure that there's not a problem. Because for me, I spent years working with Child Protective Services in Reno. And it goes back to, I think, what the judges want is the safety of the children and what is in the best interest of the child. And so if the child is in an unsafe environment, being in the custody of somebody who's driving drunk or something like that, then I believe that is the truth needs to come out. And so the best case scenario, and again, a lot of clients aren't going to consent to letting the ex-husband or this person that's you know, in the divorce with them to be able to talk to that person. But when I'm working with adolescents or I'm training interns to work with adolescents, I say get consents to speak with school teachers, probation officers, parents, so then you get a full picture of the whole truth, because that is a very good chance that adolescent's not going to tell you really what's going on.
Yeah, get on their MySpace. That's where you really
right, exactly, right.
And or there's Facebook.
There's other ways to get information, and then the evaluator can contradict what the person actually told them in the session,
sure,
the evaluation, with what all of these other documents and interviews produce.
Which is actually a bigger sign that there's a problem if somebody's downplaying it.
Exactly.
I would agree with what Jason said too, and take it even a step further. I believe our family court wants a parent to be sober more than the criminal system. The criminal system may have intended to do that at its origination, but I think now they're more worried about their numbers looking successful on paper. Hence Court Connect, and they're every Wednesday when you go to drug court, we're going to test you. Like, that's a smooth, you know, move. Gee, why don't we tell them exactly when they'll be tested and be surprised that they keep testing clean? Family court does not do that. When we say random, we mean random. And we absolutely want to make sure someone is sober. But my question to you, Jason, is what is the success rate of someone forced to become sober when they had no intention or acceptance of the fact that they had a problem or intention of getting sober? Because we force it in family court a lot, and it doesn't appear to be that successful, unfortunately, even when their kids are on the line.
Right. I think a lot of times nobody else can make the person get sober except for the person that has the problem. And so a lot of forced, mandated treatment doesn't work. However, I have seen enough people go through the court system where at the end – they were thankful for it, and it did
yeah.
work. But it is a small percentage, I agree.
Well, except one of the things that I really like is that SCRAM bracelet.
Right.
And for those people that don't know what it is, then good for you, because you're not a total idiot. But if you work in my world, the SCRAM bracelet is a bracelet that attaches to your ankle, and it measures the metabolization of alcohol in your system at any point. And often our courts order someone to wear it for a minimum of 60 days straight. And it guarantees that it'll send a, you know, whatever signal to a computer if you drink within that 60-day time frame, and it'll tell the court and or the monitor. But you can't trick it. You can't take it off. You can't stick a piece of paper between, you know, the sensor and your skin. So if you drink, it will tell them. And I have seen a number of people be successful in making it the 60 days, and then they're kind of through, like, the detox phase, whether they like it or not. And often they've had some success forced on them. The sad thing about alcohol and me and what I've seen is it seems that they drink again a year or two later, just because society makes them think they can do it, you know, under control or whatever the reasons are. But it does seem to work, at least for the 60-day period, and typically a couple months to a year after that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I like the SCRAM bracelet too, and I have made that recommendations directly to the judge in certain cases.
Mm-hmm.
Because It's where there's somebody's continually trying to manipulate the system or missing tests or all these excuses. And that at least gets to the truth. And I had one young lady a couple years ago. She used to like to drive drunk. Well, by the time she got close to her third DUI, this scram bracelet, I believe, is what kept her sober for that. Well, it was 90 days she had it on.
Yeah.
And it was through the summer, and she was upset because she wanted to wear
it's not attractive
and all of that.
It's a big old
but
advertising.
At the end of the year that she spent with me, she was grateful for it because that thing kept her sober long enough to get to see how she wanted to change her behavior and was grateful for it. So she would be one of the examples of a forced client in that had a good benefit from treatment.
And I, like I said, I have seen that. It is $10 a day, too, to wear it.
Right,
and
it's expensive.
And you drinkers get to pay for it. So that incentivizes it as well because it's an expensive thing to be paying for to be caught drinking again. So
yeah.
I really like it a lot and wish, you know, was a little less expensive so people could, you know, wear it longer.
Well, I spent a lot more than $10 a day when I was drinking. So
that's probably a good point. Although it's my husband's paying for the women's alcohol and not the scram bracelet. So it's just a matter of source. We have another break coming up. If you guys sit tight, we will be back after the break and we'll talk more about the formal evaluation process and the self-reporting effects of it, as well as the effects on families in general. We'll be right back.
I'm looking through you. Where did you go? I thought I knew you. What did I know? You don't look different, but you have changed.
You're back on the Marilyn York Show. Thanks for hanging through the break. And we are talking to Jason Natwara about addiction. So we were talking about evaluations, the formal evaluation process, which is sort of a court implemented thing in the family court system very often, and also I'm sure in the criminal system for DUIs and whatnot. We have a caller on line one, though. Let's talk to Sarah before we get deep into our conversation. Sarah, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right, Sarah, what's your question for Jason?
My question is I'm just what kind of testing exactly is it that they do, and how do they know that that these people are staying on track with, you know, substance abuse and any evaluation that is done?
So the civil system, criminal system, or any system, you don't care?
Any system.
Okay. Well, for us in the civil system, there's a lot of random testing that goes along with. So what we do first, and Jason can tell you what the sort of recommendations are, but we have the evaluation done. Someone like Jason will do the evaluation and make recommendations at the end. I recommend that they be tested this often, that they wear a scram bracelet, that they do inpatient treatment if their, you know, addiction is severe enough, that they go to AA meetings. And then our court is sort of the babysitting mechanism where they say, if you go to AA meetings once every 2 days, like he tells you to, get someone to sign to verify that, in fact, you went to AA, you know, because normally there's no verification process for AA unless you're in the criminal system. And I don't even know how good it is. So we'll babysit it. And in the family court, there's random testing. So if it's alcohol, it'd be a breathalyzer. If it's drugs, it would be a urine and or hair test. But what you answer it better, Jason, I'm just giving the court version. Tell us from an evaluation standpoint how you try to keep them honest.
Well, as far as testing, you don't really do a test at the evaluation. But if you feel the person that came in
is drunk when they show up,
right, you don't do it. Or what I usually ask, you know, one of the first questions is how, you know, when was the last time you used drugs or alcohol? And if it was like last night, well, I'll say, well, let's reschedule this appointment.
So you're sober?
Exactly.
Good luck, though, Jason.
Right. Okay. And so that's the thing. So there it goes back to the self-reporting thing. So the person comes in for the evaluation. There's usually not any testing that goes along with that. But based on the evaluation, you do a whole biopsychosocial history. You look at their criminal history, their family history, their substance use history. And then based on that information, there may be a DSM-4 diagnosis of substance abuse or substance dependence. And then we go on a level of care placement criteria by what's called ASAM placement criteria. There's where you decide, based on how high or low they rate on six different categories, whether they would be recommended for residential treatment or intensive outpatient treatment or a lower level of outpatient treatment where they come to a couple of groups a week in an individual session for a period of time. So it is on a varying continuum. But if I see somebody has a problem and they're minimizing or they're hiding it, definitely the recommendation would come in for the testing. And like we were talking about in the last segment, The random testing is the best way to go, because if they know when that date they're going to be tested with they certain just, kinds yeah. of drugs, they're just going to use right up till maybe the day before. And there are, and I know the system knows it, but people pretty much ignore it, that there are ways to use right up till the day you test it.
Melting
and
then, pot.
Right, whatever it is. You know, you can go
special and... Special shampoo.
Right. And so there's ways that people cheat the test. And so what we're really looking for is to motivate people to want to make the change themselves. And the people who have the best outcomes are the ones who really want the help.
Well, and the random testing will incentivize their sobriety.
Exactly.
Even if they have moments where they feel like
right.
they want to slip or are going to slip, that will incentivize them, particularly if there's a criminal component or a more severe civil
sure.
sanction, like you're losing your children.
Right. And so that's in a way where the system does work to keep them sober for a period of time. And like were you saying, if you can keep them sober long enough, maybe their brain gets clear enough for them to start to really internalize their value system and look at their priorities and decide for themselves they want to make a change.
Did I answer your question, Sarah?
Yes, it does. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Speaking of extra sort of repercussions of being an addict, Jason, educate us in the non-drinking world what emotional and mental issues come with addiction.
Oh, boy, that runs the whole gamut. I mean, for me, I see a lot of depression and anxiety-related disorders that go along with it. But I mean, it can be, for me, addiction is like an obsessive compulsive type disorder anyway. And so that's an anxiety disorder. But you know, I don't know. I mean,
is there like, I feel like they lie chronically. That's one of the things that they have a chronic dishonesty.
Right. Okay. So a lot of times I maybe see a personality disorder. And I think when somebody is, and that's what's.
And it starts about alcohol. They start lying about how much they drink.
Mm-hmm.
Then they start lying about where they were because they were drinking, who they
right.
were with because they were drinking, where they spent their money because they were drinking. You know, and then they just become, it seems like, pathological liars.
Sure. And that's a very interesting thing that you bring that up, because that's why I am a marriage and family therapist trained in mental health on top of an addictions counselor who has a very deep understanding, not only in my own life, but many, many clients over the years, what addiction is like, is that you need to get the person sober first before you do any kind of mental health diagnosis, because a lot of the symptoms of intoxication or continuing using, the person seems very selfish and self-centered and
mm-hmm.
narcissistic
yeah.
and you know, those kinds of behaviors. Like, they don't care about their family. But when they get sober, a lot of that can change. You
but doesn't
I mean?
It take time?
Right. It takes a long time. For
I feel
alcohol,
like our judges are kind of missing that. They're upper middle class judges who are successful individuals and may not have had personal experience. I feel like some of our judges kind of think, oh, mom's been sober 30 days. Give her back her kid. And
right.
I'm like, oh, my God, she's been an addict for 10 years.
Right.
And now she's an instant, you know, joint physical custodian again when she's never worked through all the repercussions of her long-term alcohol abuse, not to mention the impact on the kid.
Right.
I mean, what the heck do you think the kid experienced for 10 years of drunk mom? I
right.
mean, they might not feel exactly safe to rush right back to drunk mom. So I do appreciate the mental health component and wish that the court appreciated it more.
Well,
I think it might even be more significant at times.
Right. Well, and even if there's not a mental health component, let's say the you know, because like I said, when they get sober, the depression and the anxiety, a lot of what appears to be mental health symptoms might go away. Even the personality disorder, kind of narcissism stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, hopefully.
And then they maybe start taking care of their kids better and all of that.
Yeah.
But for me, 30 days is just the beginning. And if you look at all the research, long-term treatment shows the best outcomes.
And what do you mean by long-term?
Well, I think at least a year of a structured kind of a treatment that probably would hopefully include AA or NA.
But well, and personal
it's
counseling.
It's interesting that you bring up the AA and NA, too, because the courts used to try to mandate that, and then they tried to pressure the provider to mandate it. But the way that system should be is it's a self-help. So I recommend it to everybody. But I don't make people go. It doesn't work for everybody either.
So they would go when they feel a weakness coming on.
Exactly.
That would be ideal.
Right.
I mean, obviously, I know plenty of people in the system and they say, you know what? I just feel a little uncomfortable. I'm going to go to an AA meeting tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they go to 5 in a week and then they'll go a month without any.
Right.
You know, or NA. It's kind of like a brush up whenever you feel like you need a little
yeah.
extra support.
And for
or
me, if that
honesty.
Works for somebody, that's great, because it's one of the best self-help programs. Well, it is the best self-help program ever. But if that's not what's working for somebody, what I think is more important is a good, solid support. And so maybe they have support in church or their family or a new group
private
of friends,
counseling.
Right, or the private counseling.
We do a lot of private counseling for higher end or public officials, because as much as NA is anonymous, come on. I mean, you're in a group of like casino executives
and
friends. And if you have a security clearance issue or a military background or, you know, just in general would be embarrassed and therefore it's not going to be successful for you because you can't be honest in the group setting.
Right.
We always recommend private or, you know, private group or individual therapy for the same benefit.
Well, and that's why a lot of people do choose to come see me individually. And it has to do with the confidentiality. And they know in the room with me alone, confidentiality is guaranteed. But in any kind of group environment, there's a risk that somebody else in the group, whether it's AA or a substance abuse group, may spill the beans and say what that person was there or that person what they said. And so they maybe, and a lot of times they're less likely to be honest and get the help that they need. And so there's an interesting dynamic because a lot of the DUI sentencing is that people need to go to group for 52 weeks.
Yeah.
Well, maybe what they need is a lot of individual counseling.
And maybe only 10 weeks of individual because it's
and
more...
make a lot more progress and get a lot more in-depth of what the real problem is. Where in group, they maybe they're just kind of hiding in the corner.
Or listening.
They don't feel comfortable
and
they're not getting anything out of it. So.
Yeah. No, I agree. It just depends on the individual. And I'm pleased to say our family court tailors as best they can to the specific...
All treatment should be individualized.
Absolutely. We have another break coming up, and before we do, I just want to remind everyone to go to Junkie Clothing Exchange while we're talking about alcohol. Like I said, I've never been drunk, but I feel like that's what drunk feels like when I go into Junkie at 960 South Virginia because it's like entertaining and silly and makes me laugh and have a fun time, and things just look a little crazy there. So maybe you people that drink can tell me if I'm off my rocker or if that's how you feel when you go in there. It's open every day from 11 to 7, and we'll be back after the break to finish up this session with Jason. Thanks so much.
I've seen the needle and the damage done. A little part of it in everyone. But every junkie's like a setting sun.
You're back on the Marilyn York Show. Thanks for hanging through the break. And we are with Jason Natwara, and we are talking about addiction. So, Jason, one of the things that I want to understand a little better, maybe you can help me, is what is the impact on the enablers? You know, I have these parents in my office that have the grandparents will come in with the, you know, parent or their grandbaby's daddy or mommy that's their child that's drinking too much, and they're enabling and they enable and they enable. Or I have the teenagers that have been impacted that come in and have a drinking parent and spend 2 years covering for their mom before they tell their dad that mom is driving them to school drunk every day. And, you know, what goes on in their head? I don't understand the enabling, and yet I can see how it can happen.
Oh, boy. I can't really answer what goes on in their head. But in terms of that's, again, the family systems dynamic that you see. And so I think a lot of people, especially young people, I mean, again, I can talk for myself. When I was younger, I kind of felt like it was my responsibility to take care of mom or, you know, put her to bed and those kinds of things. And so the roles sometimes reverse with parents and children.
They do. They seem like they protect them and they say, if I tell you, Dad, and you take me for mom, who's going to help her get ready in the morning or get her up for work because she's not sober?
And then so some people call that the parentified child. And so those reversing of roles is really a bad thing that happens in the system that, you know, that hopefully that they can move back around because the child needs to be a child, not, you know, taking care of the parent.
How does the other parent ask the right questions to make the child feel comfortable enough to be honest?
Oh, boy. And that's where I always try to tell everybody, if you can just be honest about, you know, and genuine about your feelings and what's really going on with you emotionally and connect with your child that way. I mean, you have to be honest about it.
Well, and I represent men, as most of my listeners know. And so men are less communicative about feelings.
Absolutely.
And it seems like they are in the dark longer with the drinking mom or the drug addict mom with the teenage child. It takes them years to tell their dad. And
well,
I feel like they're not asking the right questions.
Well, and on the parent's side, a lot of them maybe are in denial themselves, or what I've seen systems-wise is, you know, they'll come in and they'll say, okay, fix my child. And my first question is, what's going on with them? And so maybe they're not being honest about their level of alcoholism or their problems that are affecting the whole family.
Well, and they do seem to be in denial sometimes about, even when they know mom has a drinking problem or worse, a drug problem, they don't seem to think, and courts are the same way. Oh, they're teenagers, so it's not that big of a deal. You know, the teenager has their own driver's license. Well, no, the teenager has their own driver's license. So if mom's a meth user, I don't care because it's not a little kid. So they can drive themselves. And I'm like, oh my God, they're more susceptible than ever. This is the worst time. And what about the culture that comes with it?
Right.
People that use meth aren't exactly high falutin society people that are over there with your teenage daughter.
Right.
I mean, what are you doing? To me, it's almost riskier because
I agree with you. You know, and it's interesting. HBO did a great series on addiction, and I use it in some of my classes and let some of my clients look at some of the segments that they produced. And
what's it called? Do you remember what it's called?
It's called Addiction, and it's like six different segments, and they show what happens with families. I just lost my train of thought.
Well, fair enough. They had that Faces of Meth too, or that, you know, Dark Crystal Meth series too, that was a couple of years ago, that was apparently really good. And I know a lot of the judges watched it and really, you know, educated them on the impact of this sort of thing. But as far as counseling goes with the families, do you involve the whole family when you counsel?
Ideally.
Because that seems to make sense to me.
There's exactly. Right. But that's the problem with the dynamic. Because like I said, going back with a lot of the parents are in denial about their children having a problem because they don't want their own problems to be exposed.
Absolutely.
And so I love working with adolescents, and especially with anybody, I try to include as many supportive others. And that's what I call them, because a lot of times they're not family.
In
the process, and then supportive others are the ones that are going to be really wanting to help that person get sober, which requires moving away from a lot of the unhealthy people in their life.
Absolutely. So would it be helpful in the court system, should we have an order that requires the entire family to participate, as you recommend, in the counseling process when you're dealing with one particular individual?
Ideally, if you could, but not when you're talking about your types of situations.
They don't have to be there at the same time. I don't want my clients choking each other in your office.
That's what I'm saying.
They can come separate. You decide that.
Right, that
they are required to participate per your recommendations.
Sure. And I think there's a lot of family dynamics that need to be worked out. As, like I said, when the person gets sober, then a lot of things change in the family. And the communication and conflict resolution and problem-solving skills aren't there. And so they could really benefit from everybody being able to gather around and be supportive of the individual with addiction. And then as they get sober, the whole family kind of heals together.
If two individuals in the same family get sober together, does that typically result in a higher success rate, or does it make it harder?
Well, I think if they're planning on staying together, and a lot of couples are like this, if they're planning on staying together forever, ideally they're both going to stay sober and make that commitment to being supportive to one another.
And they need to be.
Right. I always talk to people about this, is the biggest fear is if one of them falls, there's a high likelihood the other one will go right along with them.
I've seen that, and I also see that that ends in divorce sometimes, because the one that's determined to stay sober is determined to stay sober, and they terminate the marriage because the other one isn't.
Sure. And
then even though they love them,
and resentment,
and they don't want to.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that sometimes is the only answer to keeping them sober.
Mm-hmm.
It's heartbreaking, but it seems to be, you know, something that needs to happen in those instances. Do you recommend Al-Anon or Alateen? Do you think those are good programs for someone that has a family member that?
I do, just because there's really nothing else for family members to go to really, besides maybe private therapy.
Sure,
marriage and family therapists like myself.
That has that extra credential.
Right. But other than that, what's nice about AANA, Al-Anon, Alateen is it's free help.
Yeah.
And it is a supportive group, and there is a structure to it. And so I do also, just like I recommend everybody go to AA or NA, at least give it a try, I recommend families to go to Al-Anon, and so that they can learn how to take care of themselves. That goes back to your enabling question. A lot of times they're enablers, and Al-Anon, and especially Al-Anon and Alateen will teach them how to take care of themselves and stop enabling the bad behavior of the person who has a problem.
It's heartbreaking. I see families that have had a death of a child, and then, you know, one of the children that survived goes to addiction due to the loss of their sibling.
Right.
And that parent they just cannot give up on the, you know, substance abuse child because they already lost a child.
Sure.
And they are so, it's heartbreaking.
Right.
I can't imagine them ever getting the strength to, you know, cut the druggie off, you know, like they probably need to.
Right. Well, and that's a hard one. And I talk to parents about that when they're just about ready to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I talk to them about the serious consequences if they do that. What I try to tell parents is, how can we have you be supportive with boundaries? And
okay.
You be very clear and specific about your boundaries, and they start to bake those boundaries. Now it's their choice that they're living on the street. So it gets the parent out of being the bad one.
Okay.
You know what? My door is always open for you.
When you're sober.
When you're sober and
not
you come
stealing
in
from
and
me.
You can live in our house by our rules.
Yeah.
And so there may be a curfew, and we may expect you to be here at dinner time or whatever. And if they could be supportive of the person, I recommend that. But if the addict or the person with the problem keeps breaking the boundaries, then they say, "I'm sorry, that was your choice. You chose that over this."
Okay, that so does. When you choose I like to get that. Sober, it's more positive.
Exactly. Because the other way, there could be a separation for life, and then that just perpetuates the problem, I think, a lot of times.
Yeah, no, that does make some sense. Do you have some information you want to provide our listeners, like a website or a phone number, so they can get a hold of you if they're listening and want to find out if they have an addiction problem or get some personal counseling? Or
sure, absolutely. The easiest way to find out about me, my credentials, you can see what my office looks like inside and out at my website at www.notaworry.org. On there, I also have a online level one DUI school.
It's
the first button in the category section, and it's really simple to go through. And so if anybody has a level one DUI mandate from the court, they can do it 8 hours online, the test and everything.
Can people do it if they don't have a mandate, if they just want to try to work through
somebody? Sure. And you know what? I'm going to start to talk to maybe some of the high schools about maybe having it as an alcohol education program, because really it is
that's
8 hours
you need to
of
start.
Education.
No, and that's where people need to start, maybe even junior high, if we're being sadly realistic.
Right. Okay. That's where I kind of lost my –
it's true.
You finally brought me back to my point about that HBO addiction series. Uh-huh. Is that what they were talking about is it is a young person's disease. And
yeah.
So really prevention and education to young people with the honest truth. I mean, I think the government made a mistake years ago by putting a lot of propaganda out about marijuana. And then young people ever since then have mistrust the government. And so what I think is to just get the truth out there. And that's like crystal darkness and those types
yeah,
of things.
Yeah, it's really young. It's like right. 11, 12. I mean, well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Jason. It was very educational. I appreciate the subject, even though it's dark. And I'm sorry I wasn't funny today. For those that are used to that, I could not be that funny about this. It's too sad and hard on families. And we appreciate you coming and give Jason a call if you guys think you need the counseling or you are curious about a family member. And otherwise, we will be back next week and join the Facebook fan page or get on themarilynyorkshow.com to see what the upcoming show schedule is. Talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.
Fox News Radio, AM 1270, KBZZ, Sparks, Reno, a service of Americom Broadcasting.